Hi, welcome to Holden Village. Today in the fireside room is Jackie Brolsma, and she will be speaking on the 12 steps groups. Are they replacing the church? So let's listen in on Jackie.
12 step groups, are they replacing the church? It's kind of a radical title, but at this time you need to get a lot of people, you gotta get people's interest to come to the session. But I wanna make some opening comments just about the fact that my experience with 12-step groups has primarily been working in the field of addiction for almost 20 years, where the 12-step groups play a major role in many people's recovery. And my experience has been in a variety of settings, and I think it's important to say that I'm not here to particularly advocate for 12-step groups or to be critical of them. I'm going to try to present a balanced view and try to weave in some of the issues involved in sort of their popularity in these last few years. And I'm going to assume that you may have had some experience with them or know a little bit about them, but I do have just a copy of the 12 steps from Alcoholics Anonymous if any of you are interested in just sort of referring to them, because I am going to take some time to describe 12-step groups and some of the components of them just as a basis for our discussion. And then I'll talk about some of the issues involved in their popularity and some of the criticisms of them. And then I just want to open it up for discussion around your experience with them and questions you have about them and what you think the church's relationship ought to be to them and some of those questions. So as some people have said, when you ask a question, how do the 12 steps work, many people who are members will say they work just fine, thank you, and leave it at that. I think the history of AA really began back almost 60 years ago now, in 1935, when a stockbroker and a physician got together and really were both struggling with their own alcoholism and wanted to find a way to do that. It has some roots in the Oxford movement, which was a post-World War I sort of Christian evangelical movement, and so it does have some connections to some Christian roots. And it wasn't begun by a brilliant therapist or professionals, but rather two people who were really trying to come to grips with their own powerful addiction to alcohol. And that is really what birthed Alcoholics Anonymous, so it's been around a long time. And since then, you have heard a vast number of 12-step groups that have kind of come from those, starting first with Al-Anon and going to, I think, Gamblers Anonymous was the next one, and Overeaters Anonymous, Emotions Anonymous, Narcotics Anonymous. We now see Schizophrenics Anonymous, Parents and Families Anonymous, Mistresses Anonymous, Cocaine Anonymous, Adult Children of Alcoholics Anonymous. And we see them for those people who are addicted to religion, sex, money, shopping, relationships, worrying, and the list goes on and on. Some considered to be the most powerful therapy in America today. And on a more humorous note, people have talked about the fact that there's even a Paranoids Anonymous now, but you seem to call up to try to find out where they're meeting and they won't tell you because of their paranoia. But there's been a flood of books employing the 12 steps as a framework for spiritual growth, and anthologies of prayers and meditation books, and you've seen the self-help sections of many bookstores. A bit about the description of the organization. It's not officially connected with any religious denomination or cause or organization. There are no hard and fast rules. There are no fees to be members. It has minimal amount of organization. In fact, they pride themselves more on their disorganization than on their organization. It has a spirit that's based on attraction, rather than promotion. Their PR policy is not to go out and recruit people. It's rather, come, if you like what you experience, come back again. newcomers are generally very warmly welcomed. There's a really an atmosphere of acceptance and understanding. People share their experience, strength, and hope. They are informal and purely voluntary. They tend to provide a prescription for recovery and living. They're non-professional. They are leaderless. Everything is optional. Help is really available anytime. And they move at a self-directed pace. So you wonder, well, how can that possibly work with all of that sort of chaos going on? The 12-step programs tend to provide a philosophy of life. And they say that they can be harmonious with one's own personal theology and spiritual beliefs. Some people have described it this way, that it's the house that Alcoholics Anonymous helps one build for oneself is different for each occupant, because each occupant is their own architect. And for many, AA is a kind of going home, a return like the prodigal son to the house and to the faith of their fathers. To others, it's a never-ending journey into lands they did not dream existed. It doesn't matter into which group one falls. Some say it's one of many creative tools available to people, and it has a way of teaching people how to live peacefully, happily, successfully, promoting healing, and bringing peace. They pride themselves on being very simple. And one of their slogans actually are the more famous one that people use, keep it simple, stupid. They say that they're not religious, yet six of the steps, if you notice, will put you in direct contact with a loving God you are not required to understand. And they have sometimes been said to be a radically different understanding of spiritual power. Some people have said that a six-word summary for the 12 steps are these: trust God, clean house, your own house, and serve others. Kind of a simple, approach to life. Some people have wondered about its relationship to treatment, and some people equate sometimes the 12-step groups with therapy or treatment, when in actuality they maintain no relationship whatsoever, except that people who are recovering from addiction often, through their therapy and treatment, are encouraged to use the 12 steps. I think this story is perhaps a helpful way to maybe understand that relationship. Picture ourselves standing on the shore. Way across the water is an island called Serenity, where peace, happiness, and freedom exist from the despair of alcoholism and other problems. We really want to get to that island, but we've got to find a way to get across the water, that huge void that stands between us and where we want to be. We have two choices. In the water is an ocean liner, a cruise ship that looks real posh and cozy. It's called treatment, therapy. Next to it, on the beach, sits a group of odd-looking people. They appear to be rowing a boat, but we can't see a boat, and we can't see the oars. We only see these happy people sitting on the beach, rowing an invisible boat with invisible oars. The invisible boat is called AA, Al-Anon, or any other 12-step program. The ocean liner haunts, summoning us aboard the treatment and therapy crews. We can't see the people on board. We can see the people on board. They're happy and waving to us. And then there's these goofy people hollering at us to join them in their invisible boat. Would we choose the liner or the invisible boat? Of course, we'll get on the ocean liner, the luxury cruise. The next thing we know, we're heading toward that island of happiness. The problem is, about midway across the water, the ocean liner stops, turns around, and heads back to the shore where we started from. Then the captain orders everyone on the ship. When we ask why, everyone off the ship, rather, when we ask why, he says, our cruise only goes so far. The only way you can ever get to that island is by getting in the invisible boat, called AA or Al-Anon. So we shrug our shoulders and walk over to the people in the boat. "Get in," they holler. "We can't see any boat to get into," we holler back. "Get in anyway," they say. So we get in, and pretty soon they say, "Pick up an oar and start rowing," working the steps. "Can't see any oars," we holler back. "Pick them up and start rowing anyway," they say. So we pick up invisible oars and start rowing. And pretty soon we see the boat. Before we know it, we see the oars too. Next thing we know, we're so happy rowing the boat with the goofy people, we don't care if we ever get to the other side. That's one way some people in the program might describe it. Richard Rohr, I think he's a Catholic priest. Is he far? He's some ordained person, has called the 12 steps an amazing gift of the Spirit. And Gerald May, a popular writer who wrote a book called Addiction and Grace, he's actually a psychiatrist and I believe has also maybe studied some theology, wrote that book called Addiction and Grace. But both of them sort of really lift up the 12 steps for ways of getting at spirituality that in some ways the church has failed. Richard Rohr calls them the spirituality behind them can be solidly founded in scriptures and tradition. And he calls them a clear, practical distillations of centuries of religious wisdom presented in a way that avoids all smokescreen of piety and soft devotion. And people don't hang around them unless they want to really change their life. He believes that they have the ability to counter the individualism of our culture. In one of their traditions, they say our common welfare should come first. Personal recovery depends on AA unity. Another tradition says, sees God expressed and known in community, and there's no kind of private me and Jesus. They describe their leaders as but trusted servants, which he maintains is a counter to seeing the church arguing about what is true ordination. Their PR policy is based on attraction rather than promotion, and believes that in many ways truth, like beauty, is what sells itself. He also maintains that the spirituality in the 12 steps are similar to the Latin American Christian-based communities, sort of a low church approach to evangelism and healing. He believes in many ways they could be a first world answer to these Christian-based communities, and many of us have probably described our suffering in the first world as one of psychological, relational, and addictive, where the suffering of people who are comfortable without, but oppressed and empty within. And we face a crisis of meaninglessness and false self, trying to find meaning in possession, material wealth, prestige, and power. And when that doesn't work, we turn to adjusting and buying to fill our empty souls, thus calling for a spiritual awakening. And he believes in many ways that they're a gift of a model to view injustice. I want to talk about some clear movements that are at work in the 12 steps, then offer up some critiques, and then open it up to some discussion. Many have said that there are really six clear movements at work in these 12 steps. First of all, there's an acceptance of what is, sort of a grounded in reality and just accepting that, okay, this is the way things are, and so we move on. There's an acceptance of a limited self, a limited world with limits demanded of all would-be brothers and sisters, and that really only God is limitless. Thirdly, there's a commitment to truth about myself and about how maybe I've hurt other people. There's a commitment to fellowship and community. The meetings and the apologies and the responsibility for relationships are mandated with a sense of courage to make amends, where the notion of sponsorship is taken serious, having a relationship to another person that we're somehow held accountable for, to and for. And then there's an unapologetic commitment to a personal God. think if you take a look, steps 2, 3, 6, 7, and 11 talk about that relationship, a sort of outside myself. And then finally, a commitment to loving service, especially in that final step, where spirituality is not a narcissistic trip. In looking at those 12 steps, I think each of them can be summarized. First of all, the first one being a focus on humility, the second one focusing on trust, the third one focusing on surrender, the fourth one on repentance, the fifth on confession, the sixth on self-emptying, the seventh on dependence, the eighth on accountability, followed by responsibility, and then finally honesty, discipline, and service. They're sometimes praised for incorporating religion and psychology, which has always been a long-time tension. This might be another way of getting at that relationship. This is a quote. Recently, a friend, speaking of her troubled son, said to me, "His father thinks he needs religion, but I think he needs a psychologist. There seems to be an all one or the other attitude for many people." Psychiatrist Scott Peck, author of The Road Less Traveled, notes that many therapists review religion as the enemy because they've seen so many people who are crippled by guilt, I deserve punishment, or have had a distorted religion used against them by their families. On the other hand, how many people have you heard say, "All shrinks are crazy themselves, I'd never go to one"? But the amazing success of 12-step programs in using religion and psychology continues to rise amid sinking church membership and those people we all know who have been in therapy for years without much change. Many shrinks don't seem to move to the healing power of love and forgiveness after discovering who done who wrong. At the same time, many religions can only offer very shallow and meaningless forgiveness if the psychological dynamics remain unconscious and the pain of the wrongdoing is not felt and used. This is calm confrontation. So maybe even saints need shrinks to clear up whom to forgive for what, and shrinks may need saints to find out how. Another way of looking at that relationship. Not everybody's been so happy with the 12 steps as a solution. Let's talk about some of the criticisms they've been made. One group thinks that they're so religious, they've organized a response to it called the SOS movement, Secular Organization for Sobriety. And then some have gone the other way and said that they're not Christian enough and have really developed more explicitly Christian and biblical sorts of treatment approaches. But for the most part, really, 12-step groups espouse to keep a very guarded distance from organized religion. And organized religion has historically returned that compliment. Some of the critiques, this proliferation of 12-step groups, I talked a little bit about in my first session about the overuse of addiction. They've even reached to the point that some have warned of a kind of addiction chic, sort of a self-help problem, perpetuating a lot of profit-making and affluence through all of the overuse of addiction as a metaphor. And I spoke a lot about the caution and hazards of doing that in the other session, and we can go in some of that direction if we want to in the discussion. But they can't be, use addiction to apply and apply it loosely to all the problems that people have in society. Some would argue that in discussing the theological implications of the 12-step programs, that the basic spiritual problem remains injustice, and that we never get at that issue in continuing to kind of have this proliferation of 12-step groups. Others would also criticize the 12-step programs for not recognizing really all of the political and social conditions that set the stage for all the individual and family problems. Others have argued that the 12-step language is unconsciously very patriarchal. The original words, of course, use him to describe God. Women for Sobriety is an organization that has sort of responded to that. And there was an article recently in Ms. Magazine countering some of the over-labeling that goes on and criticizing also for this effort to sort of break down people's over-inflated egos, and that it fails to sort of look at the lack of women's healthy awareness of their own power, and that's exactly what women don't need to have happen, but they need more affirmation of their own inner strength and wisdom. And criticizing them for basically it was, you know, formed by a bunch of white middle-class males. And that they tend to get people stuck in chronic sort of recovery rather than moving them more towards from recovery to the notion of discovery. And that there's this notion that you have to always constantly be fixed. So do the commendations far outweigh the criticisms? We hear life-saving stories when we go to their meetings. But has the growing appreciation closed the distance between the many groups that meet in church basements but never seem to sort of drift up any further and have a deeper relationship? And for many years, you know, these 12-step groups have only met in church basements, but not much except their smoke really has kind of gone any further. And I think in some ways this is changing. I think many religious leaders are beginning to suspect that there's, you know, more lives being transformed in some of those basements, perhaps, and then in some of the pews. And is there something to be gained from asking the question of whether or not the failure of the church to draw these individuals in? A New York Times article a couple years back was entitled, "Clerics Wonder Whether Religion Can Learn Lessons from Recovery Programs for Addicts." And a pastor she compares the faceless men and women meeting at the church to the prodigal son of Jesus' parable. They've hit bottom and are on a journey home. But instead of celebrating their return with a fatted calf like the father in the parable, she said, too many church members are more like the parable's elder brother who balks at this welcome. So, those are just some introductory comments I think we can talk about. You know, maybe what are some of the lessons organized religion or the church maybe could learn from the 12-step groups? What do they maybe have to offer each other? And what do you think of this proliferation of these groups? And what are there ways that perhaps some positive links could happen? So, comments, questions, your own experiences.
What you touched on at the end, I think, is very relevant because we have some meeting in our church. Mm-hmm. Down the block is a congregational church. We had a little fire this summer when a group was smoking outside and caused the fire to happen, which I guess caused a little division even among the congregation to a point like whether they should have in there. It certainly is fertile ground that we need to recognize that you're not the older brother. And in Oregon, we have a very large cult that has multiplied rapidly called Living Enrichment Center. Now has a new building down in the line that Wilson Building used to be in Beaverton and all over there. And they basically are kind of like the 12-step. They have a lot of 12-step programs, and then they take a little bit of Christianity, a little bit of Buddhism, and they are meeting. It's cynically called the Feel-Good Church, but they are obviously meeting a lot of needs. Mm-hmm. And I think we as Christians need to look at why are people flocking to them and not to us? not that we delete the gospel, but how do we deal with that? I guess that's why I'm here.
Mm-hmm.
Because I have friends who have done that, who have left our church and have gone there and have tried to convince me. It's just great.
Mm-hmm. So you've seen people sort of leave the church.
To a point, or
mm-hmm.
and go to this. They didn't go from ours necessarily. Well, yes, a couple have moved to church, but from Presbyterian, Catholic churches, Dutch Reformed churches, and,
mm-hmm.
and saying how it meets the needs. Well, we don't always do that. We don't incorporate it, obviously, as part of our
mm-hmm.
worship.
Well, I think there's something we can pay attention to in terms of what grabs people
mm-hmm.
there. Have anybody had the other experience of perhaps people eventually coming back to the church because of perhaps an experience?
Well, I see a lot in seminaries, at least at the seminary that I've been at Harvard Divinity School. A lot of the students are there, especially women students, interestingly, mm-hmm. because of having found God through a 12-step group and then wanting to go further with that. And so for some people, they've had less experience with actual churches than they have with 12-step groups, but now want to move more into theological study.
Mm-hmm.
And it's sometimes a problem when they want to become pastors because they've had less actual church experience than they have 12-step groups. They sort of use that as the image of church in some ways. So,
mm-hmm.
But it's exciting to see the number of people who have been in recovery and have had that powerful experience.
Just a comment. I've been reading very recently about what's called the therapeutic society. Past 50, 60 years of increasingly religion therapy in society where the goal of, the greatest goal is the happiness of the individual, which is not necessarily the way it has been, and not necessarily consistent with at least Orthodox Christian, Christian theology. And it seems like 12-step groups, as you suggested, are able in a way to put religion at the service of the therapeutic model or the therapeutic society. The idea here is to help people get better, and God's role is to help them find happiness. And there, and the role of the people in here then is to go out and find others who are, here it says alcoholics, but others who are in a similar state of unhappiness, and bring them in so that God can help them find the same happiness as well. I wonder the extent to which this is terribly consistent with Christianity. It certainly is consistent with the therapeutic society.
Mm-hmm.
And I wonder the extent to which it's, except for those churches where it seems like the idea, the reason you come to church is to be happy.
Mm-hmm.
And there are rapidly growing churches where you come because you want to be happy, you want to be entertained, you want to have all of your kind of needs met, and go out and bring others so they can be happy. I would imagine that there could be a consistent move from us to 12-step program to that sort of a church, but if you're at all an Orthodox Lutheran, it doesn't seem like there would be as much consistency as with some others.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Not speaking for any 12-step group, again, I'd say that they would also make a distinction between the fact that they don't really go out trying to recruit people, but if somebody asks for help, they would make a distinction between them. But, my own experience is, I've seen it really go in a variety of directions. I mean, I think it, for many people, it's been a real healing place or a bridge to really go back to their, given faith in some ways. And, they somehow left the organized church somewhere along the line, and then
how to kind of rediscover God through some kind of, you know, life experience, whatever that's brought them into a 12-step group. And then they perhaps continue, and eventually that becomes too anemic, and they really do want more. And that's been a real powerful thing to witness. On the other hand, I also came to Holden in 87, feeling that some of this movement was not to particularly blame 12-step groups for, but that there'd been really a increasingly narcissistic focus for our culture to be so, you know, caught up in fixing ourselves and, you know, trying to find ways that our families were, you know, damaging to us, or our parents had not served us some way. And you know, that it became a very profit-making venture as well. And for me, it's been, you know, a journey to sort of bridge those tensions, because on the one hand, you know, they've, you know, people tell incredible stories of changing their lives, and yet at the same time, the danger of also moving, you know, in that other direction, like some of the criticisms I've talked about.
Tracy, I was going to say, that one of the things that we can or need to somehow hear from 12-step groups as a church is that incredible honesty and feeling like you can reveal yourself as you truly are in a 12-step group. I haven't been to one, but that's what people say most of all. And then the church is the last place that you'll be honest when you're really having struggles and problems in your life. Mm-hmm. And I think that's are a great challenge to us. We use the confession liturgically and say that we've hit bottom every Sunday when we confess our sins, but in fact, it sometimes seems that the 12-step groups are where people are much more honest about sort of bringing pains and troubles and struggles to the community and sharing them in an honest way. And people say that they can't find that in their congregation, unfortunately. And I don't know how we as a church can take up that challenge.
How much do you think the fact they remain anonymous has to do with that? That they never give their last names and so on. Is that partly why?
Certainly a tone of safety there. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. You were going to make a comment?
I work with mainly with women who have been victimized, been wounded in childhood, and what I find is that for practically all of them, they have to go through, I work mainly with Christians, and they go through a time when the church does not meet their needs as most of our churches are set up today. They go through a time of being incredibly angry with God. They go through a time when they need to talk about their anger, when they need to talk about things that they're afraid to talk about at church, mm-hmm. and that they are not encouraged to. They need to express feelings that they feel embarrassed by doing in the pew, that there's, and so I found that the 12 steps to reconnect people in that direction has been very meaningful for most of them. Mm-hmm. I run groups for women that are not specifically 12-step, but I think 12-step groups play their part, because people who are going through this journey of life, we need all the resources we can get, and we often don't have enough mm-hmm. Christian resources. And the 12-step groups are definitely spirituality oriented, so that people struggling with God feel welcome there, and yet can be very honest. Mm-hmm. They can be, the anonymity is very important, because you often don't want to sit next to the person that you were confirmed with or whatever someone who knows your parents or whatever, and I've struggled through this. And so I guess with all kinds of things, including the church, they can go astray. And and so I think our church has a real commitment to be a part of these, to struggle with how we can unite these groups in, you know, so that they don't just stay stuck in the stage, but they can move on to what they need that only the church has to offer. And I think that's the church that's let these people down. You know, I think that's us, the church, who let the people down. I believe that that the healing that therapists are doing has always belonged in the church. You know, that's where Jesus wants us to be healed. But the church hasn't been doing it. The church hasn't been effective doing it. And so therapists have come in to fill this void. The 12-step programs have, you know, on a non-professional level, have come in to fill the void. But I believe Jesus is going to make the church accountable for this. I think we are all going to answer someday for why have we not been helping the poor, the disheartened, the hungry. Why haven't we been doing that? It's our job. That's what he's asking us to do.
One element that I think the 12-step groups maybe provide in our society, and I think the anonymity part when you're struggling with a particular thing must be really important, but I think one thing that churches are just starting to do is some of the small group things, and I think one of the things that's the most it's breaking down the fastest in our society is places for people to just be with a small group of people, since our families don't function that way, since we're so mobile and everything, that I guess, I don't know exactly, I see one of the future. I know our church is trying to work on the small group ministry thing, as far as just giving people a place to get together and get to know other people. Mm-hmm. And that doesn't, that wouldn't be duplicating what a 12-step group does, but I think that that's a real hunger in people's lives right now. And when I hear people criticize, a good friend who really was helped very much through alcohol, and I think he probably went through treatment too, but he continues to go. And what he'll criticize about the church is the lack of vulnerability among people, as Barb said, and the lack of a chance to really have community. Mm-hmm. And I think that's one thing the church really could, and we have to learn how to do, and that is to create opportunities for people to get to know each other. And in the past, it just happened because you stayed there long enough, and you know, your family had grown up. Now, people need an entree into a church because you worship next to each other, and that's just a big kind of, I mean, that's sacramental, there's a unity that goes with that. But if you don't have with that also really opportunities to get to know each other in your lives, it can be pretty sterile. So that may be one of the challenges for the church. It may not be duplicating the therapeutic parts of the 12-step.
Yeah. And they have a distinct advantage of people there obviously sharing a common interest when they come through the doors, you know. And sometimes we're so heterogeneous in our churches, although the greatest thing is to discover how common the human experience is.
And that's part of, I think, a small group experience, is to discover that despite differences. I know we're struggling in the small group ministry on what kinds of small, and trying to find ways that when a small group, how do you figure out what people want? I have book groups, and we have interest groups as far as they'll run a group for grief, a group for newly divorced, And then there's the new members, sort of small group that they call it First Friends. Mm-hmm. Some people have just joined the church, have an opportunity if they want to go into a 5-6 week small group experience for new members who they all get to know. But it, one of the hard things is to find the focal point with the foster group. You have a built-in focal point.
Mm-hmm.
And more and more, what they're also trying to, in any of the groups, incorporate an element of faith, faith exploration with whatever the small group is.
Mm-hmm.
It incorporates in some way a growth, faith growth element to us.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's good.
As in our first experience, I had the privilege of being with a parishioner and a woman during her going through her steps, and was asked her, she made her confession to.
Yeah.
And one of her observations is she was going to 12-step meetings for a while every day, and sometimes twice a day, in the early parts of her recovery. And one of her observations was people criticize the church, but they expect to get out of 1 hour of corporate worship the same thing they get out of going to daily or twice a day meetings. And that part of what she was saying is, you know, we expect that 13-minute sermon or that moment at the altar to somehow be magic for us. But in the 12th step, you realize you're not dealing with magic, but you're dealing with transformation that happens in the community.
Right.
And I think that's part of what you're saying too about small group and large group. And what do we ask church to do? Well, if we go on Sunday at 11 and walk away and say, my life was not transformed and I'm drinking again on Monday, you know,
right.
It's a misconception of what church is.
Mm-hmm.
Her other point was, in the 12-step group, everybody knew one major thing about her, and that was that she was an alcoholic. And they heard all of her horror stories. But she said she didn't have any friends there because you didn't meet outside the group. Or she didn't meet with people outside the group. So she had people who in the church knew all kinds of things about her and knew her almost as a whole human being, but didn't know this one thing.
Mm-hmm.
And in the 12-step group, they knew. And so her pastor became the bridge. Her passed by became the person who knew the whole thing.
Mm-hmm.
Both. So I would go to, I went to 12-step meetings with her.
Yeah, it's
why they defined a non-smoking one, because it was so long.
Yeah, there's lots more now, I understand.
Yeah, this was some years ago. But I guess I raised that, you know, when we criticize what the church has failed to do, I want to say, being a Christian isn't going to church at 11 o'clock on Sundays. It too is offering your life to be transformed. It too is a discipline. It too is a way of walking and living and being with one another.
Mm-hmm.
And maybe we haven't said that enough in the church. Maybe we have presented ourselves as a magical pill that you can take for an hour a week. And,
Well, you know, certainly we've probably been enculturated, you know, much like, you know, other parts of the church as well in worship. But, and I don't, you know, I'm no sort of authority in worship, but I was always struck at Holden. I mean, I really became aware of how necessary it is for worship to really spring forth from the group, and that worship has so much more meaning when you have relationship, you know, with the people around you. And I think that's one of the things that, you know, I think that a lot of people do make friends at 12-step groups, and they make this connection, and there's some kind of a relationship. And in churches, so often it's so difficult to get that movement coming this way versus the worship being imposed upon. And I think that's one of the beauties of coming and spending time at Holden, is you really begin to get, you know, the feel for how that kind of springs forth from people. And it probably, and that's the way worship originated. I mean, that was the worship of the people. And now we all commute from the suburbs perhaps to a church, and you know, we're very few neighborhood churches anymore and have relationships outside the church.
The other issue that I wonder about for the church is how do we get to the point where the expectation is that it is the place where we share our weaknesses and our vulnerabilities? Because that's the other strength, I think, of a 12-step group, that you're there to really deal with what your needs are.
Mm-hmm.
And the church, I think, basically has gotten the opposite, mm-hmm. you know, that you don't share your weaknesses in the church community, and I wonder how you change that.
Mm-hmm.
I know this friend, same friend, I mean, that's basically what he was saying. He was saying, well, there I can be who I really am. I can't do that at church.
Mm-hmm.
And I mean, that certainly isn't biblical.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, and how do we, on a practical level, change our churches so it becomes a place, I suppose, opportunities to be real with each other is one of it, but it has to do with everything from the way we dress to the way we, you know, I don't know.
Mm-hmm.
It's really, I think that's one of the biggest challenges for church, because churches have become status symbols rather than places where the needy mm-hmm. come together to be heard.
Mm-hmm. Well, that shared vulnerability is a powerful part of what I think has captured people.
And it's dangerous to over-idealize 12-step groups, too.
Oh, absolutely.
Because I have living with a brother who's sort of bouncing around from one 12-step group to another, just as some other people bounce from church to church, dissatisfied with being able to meet their needs. It's inside the world of 12-step groups, I think it's a different reality, too, where there are known good groups and there are known, you know,
absolutely.
Bad groups, and it's a complex
mm-hmm.
group. My most interesting experience with 12-step groups was from my brother, who was told that he had to have a God to be part of that 12-step group. You know, this was Alcoholics Anonymous, and there had to be a God, and if he didn't have one, then they would be his God. And the description was, this group of drunks, G-O-D, would be his God. And I've wondered whether that isn't one of the danger places, is that, as Robert Wethnow has written lately about 12-step groups, is that God is very small there. God is limited to what is possible within that group of personalities. There's no external reality that to refer to, which is larger and more embracing. And so then you do tend to digress into a, how can I get my needs met within this group? The question I have is, have places like, groups like Stephen Ministries, I don't know if you're familiar with them, Jackie.
My brother's real involved in
have, that. Have they successfully been a kind of a bridge, a middle ground between a non-church 12-step group and a church?
I just haven't heard that much about them out here.
I like the people they have in our church.
They're fairly strong. See, in the West, we don't have that many big churches that need to be broken down into small group size.
Right.
And so they're relatively less common here because of the size of the church.
Uh-huh.
I think we have a couple hundred who have gone through it, and now they're branching out to the community. One of my volunteer projects is to drive mentally troubled people to counseling in Washington County.
Yeah.
And we now have five people who are connecting with these clients, the Stephen's ministers. There are some who won't do it, but there are others who are, and the people talk about what it means to them to have this person coming and meeting them.
Yeah.
So in our small group, Bible study is striving in our church to do this. Like, we have this women's group, and married women have commented that people are more vulnerable or talk more about their problems.
Mm-hmm.
In part, we try to divide it one third prayer, one third study, and one third evangelism.
Right.
It doesn't always work that way, but we're striving.
Yeah. Well, as I said, I'm not here to defend or advocate or be only critical, but I appreciate your comments, and we can continue the discussion if you want, but I do see the buses here, so thank you.
Thank you. Thank you.
Oh, yeah, great.
Still have one.
Oh, yeah. You can go anytime, though.
And there's, in addition to that, is the fact that if you're in church, you're supposed to be a good person, so then you don't talk about the bad parts of you.
So how do we get the church to be able, you know, to be able with the whole person?
Yeah.